Uh-oh, Tom Cruise took a lawyer job that was obviously too good to be true, and it turned out to be too good to be true. Can Gary Busey save him? Absolutely not. That's about 5% of the plot of The Firm, which was the number one movie in America.
The number one movie in America.
Movie in America.
Movie in America.
The number one movie in America.
My name's Sean Collier. This is the number one movie in America. I'm here with two people who, I don't know, probably wouldn't jump down a glowing superhero hole to begin with, let alone have to respond to that problem. Robin Hitchcock.
Levitating tripod.
And Camila Adams.
You are correct. I would not jump into a hole and touch anything glowing in that hole.
Right. If somehow you jumped into a hole, which I'm not going to do, but if you jumped into the hole and then things escalated,
right?
If the jumping into the hole wasn't the most dramatic part of that day,
exactly. Exactly. Because it's not going to be. My story is I jumped in a hole. That enough would be like anybody that I would tell right. that to would be like, what the what is wrong with you? Let's do. We need to take you and get you checked right. out. Are you okay? But then be like, and then like, no, this is like, that's over. Somebody's committing me at that point. And that would be fair because Camila ain't jumping in no random holes.
We had a couple of people respond on Twitter and saying, you know, I really liked Chronicle when it came out. I don't know. I think it comes down to, like, we weren't superhero fatigued then.
Yeah.
We knew that we were entering the superhero era and it was a little bit different at a time when things weren't really different. So, okay.
Yeah, I guess it's of this era. That's probably like one of the first movies that I've encountered that was just like, oh, I just missed the mark. Like that kind of thing. Like, had I seen it? Mm-hmm. Back then, maybe I would have been a little more impressed. But, you know, now it's like I tell people, you know, I talk about Empire Records. They're like, what is that? And I'm like, you know what? It's not. You've missed it. If you haven't seen it at this point, I'm not going
to be a teenager in 1995.
Right. It's a very specific.
If you can't understand what a record store was and acknowledge that it would be very sad for one to go away,
right.
then this is not for you.
Exactly. If you've ever spent any significant amount of time tooling around in a record store.
Fortunately, we've moved on from Chronicle, and we join Sir John Grisham and his twisty legal thrillers. I know I read
Pause. He's not actually knighted, is he?
No, I just... Oh.
Is he American also?
He's American.
Pretty sure.
He seems like a guy who would somehow have a knighthood if we had them in America.
Right.
Okay.
And I assume that he's probably probably from like one of those southern states too, because all of his stuff takes place down south.
He's like the way that Stephen King is with Maine.
Right.
He is with the South.
Yeah.
I think I read some of these when I was like 11, 12 years old, because that hit right in the middle of Grishamania for me. And, you know, I was that kind of pretentious where I was like, I don't read kids' books anymore. Give me real books. Inevitably, that leads to like mass market paperbacks that are very easy to read.
Yeah.
So I read a couple of these at the time, and maybe I've seen a couple, but like when I was searching for my opinion on John Grisham and film adaptations of John Grisham in my brain, I don't know what that is. I could not locate like a feeling about this.
Yeah, I did read this book, and I think it was like it all hit like right. I read the book before I saw the movie, and I think it was like right around my time of like discovering all of these movies that were coming out that had books prior to them, and I was like determined to read the book first. And then so I think that's kind of where I was, like Waiting to Exhale and Interview with the Vampire and that kind of stuff.
For a quick second, I thought that John Grisham wrote Waiting to Exhale.
Just books that have been turned into movies. Not necessarily Grisham. I think that's the only Grisham book I read.
I don't think I ever read anything. As we've discussed, I don't read a lot of books.
But did you have a feeling about John Grisham film adaptations prior to?
Yes, absolutely. I like them. Like, yeah. Listen, I went to law school. Right. Like, I had been seduced by the drama of the legal field through a lifetime of watching movies about it. And, you know, had all the normal, like, I graduated college and I don't know how to get a job. Why not more school? Yeah, I remember watching part of this. Like, it was like a, you know, see parts of it on TBS kind of movie. And thinking that it was dry. But watching it this weekend in preparation for this episode, I found myself much more engaged. And I don't know if that's being a grown up.
It could be. How old were you when this came out?
10.
So you were probably like, you know, teens, early teens by the time it was on TBS and stuff or whatever.
Right.
And so, yeah, I could totally see it not really appealing to a younger crowd. I was definitely a senior in high school when this came out.
You know what else? I definitely had that phase that America had where we were like done with Tom Cruise, like when he jumped on Oprah's couch. I probably saw this during that era.
He had been tainted by the time you got to it. Like while he was still fresh and, you know, okay, you know, he's fine. But when this came out, but yeah, I could totally see that.
Is this the first Tom Cruise movie we've talked about?
I think so. I think this is, which is shocking to me.
Let's dispense with that and then we'll get to the recap, just so this doesn't become the Tom Cruise episode. I think clearly he's a problem for the world and everyone around him. Speaking solely of his acting, I think he is as good as a not great actor can be. Does that make sense?
Yes.
There are like great actors. There are the Philip Seymour Hoffmans of the world. Right. And then there are normal actors.
Right.
And among normal actors, you don't get much better than Tom Cruise when he's on.
Well, it's like, to me, like most of his roles could all be the same person.
Right.
Again, it's fine. Like I enjoy the Mission Impossible movies. And, you know, I'm hard pressed to find. There's only like a couple of Tom Cruise movies that I watch that I'm just like, yeah, Tom Cruise. And it's basically like Tropic Thunder, where like you don't know it's him until halfway through the movie. And it's like, that is the best Tom Cruise performance I have ever witnessed in my life. And the other one was like Interview with the Vampire. But yeah, I don't think you're right. He's not exceptional for the most part. And again, he's just like, oh God, Tom Cruise. And he's never a reason why I will watch a movie.
Yeah, like I also like the Mission Impossible movies. And like, I do consider that franchise to be like appointment viewing for me, but it's not because of Tom Cruise.
Right.
With the exception of, he is the greatest runner in the history of cinema.
Right. I was thinking that too. I was like, oh my God. Like when the scene where he's running after his wife and this one, I was like, oh, so we've been doing this for a long time.
He has always had that run nailed and it's just so good.
Well, aside from running, boy, does a lot happen in this movie. And here to try to synthesize
I don't know, man.
A transatlantic flight's worth of plot into 60 seconds. Really, this movie made me want to be on a plane for a long time. Because I was like, man, this novel would get you right through it. With the 60-second recap, here's Camila Adams. Go.
Mitch gets a job with a Memphis law firm straight out of law school. They promise him the fancy life. It all seems too good to be true, and it is. Four lawyers are mysteriously killed. Now he's suspicious. Mitch starts to investigate the boating accident in the Caymans, but lets himself get seduced by a stranger on the beach. He hooks up with Gary Busey to help figure out the dead lawyers. Jigsaw and Walter White's brother-in-law pay Busey a visit. Now he's dead. The FBI contact Mitch. Turns out the firm is dirty and represents a Chicago mafia family. They want files, and he wants to get his brother out of jail. He tells his wife they had to play pretend while Mitch gets his shit together. The firm's head of security tries to put Mitch in his place with photos of his hoe activities. Mitch is most concerned about getting disbarred. The firm is overbilling clients, and then they will send those bills. It's a federal offense. Gotcha. He has a plan that almost falls apart, so his wife secretly steps in to help. Games of cat and mouse, drugging, close calls, hanging from pipes, beating up old men, photocopies. Look, a lot of stuff happens. Mitch manages to pull it all off. Just watch it. It's worth it.
Hey, there you go. Really? I mean, you don't need to get into the end. Like, it's like, you know, more things happen and he wins.
Right.
Bye.
it's so much. Oh, God. But I enjoyed it. All 3 hours of it or whatever.
And it is weird that, you know, we've talked so much on this podcast about how we want our movies to be 2 hours or less.
Right.
And this does not need to be 2.5 hours long. And yet, I was with it the whole time.
Hey, did I make it? I didn't. Was that under 60 seconds or was I over?
No, yeah, that was about 56.
All right. Whew.
And I'm happy for you because you were really trying. You were really trying to get it.
And plus, that was the first time I usually practice it. I hadn't, so this is why I was stumbling a lot. I didn't. And then Mitch is just like kind of a difficult thing to say quickly, I guess.
I messaged my co-hosts on Saturday afternoon, I think. I was like, I'm not telling you it's not a good movie. I'm not giving away my opinion on the movie. I'm just saying you're going to pause this movie.
Right.
You are going to. It is so much happens and it's so dense that you're going to be like, I need 5 minutes. And you're going to pause it and you're going to make another pot of coffee. It's 2.5 hours long. It'll probably take you 3:30, 3:45 at home.
Right.
This is when I want TBS.
Right. Yeah, exactly. It's a long movie, and it was one of those things that, okay, yeah, I'm going to need a couple breaks, but I'm also not going to be engaged with this movie the whole time. I'm not going to be like surfing Google and all that stuff as I do it, because you need to pay attention, like, because otherwise you will be lost quickly.
It's intricate.
Yeah.
And I did a good job of writing down all my legal questions instead of Googling them in the moment.
Interesting. Should I call in our legal consultant, Daniel T. Friedson? Yes.
Yes. I didn't. I mean, I did Google, but, you know, I always would rather hear from an actual lawyer.
Here's my main legal question, and it's more, you know, philosophical than technical. If you're in this situation, the thing you would do is say, whoops, I work for the mob now, right?
Like, yeah.
No, hang on. Are you saying that you'd be like, well, this is my life?
Yes.
Basically.
No.
Basically.
Well, no, I understand he's a little upset that he's going to be monitored and controlled for the rest of his days. That's concerning. The tiny, tiny window of opportunity for any other outcome for him is so small. Like, so many things have to go right for him to get out of this alive. And then, as he repeatedly says, even if he gets out of this alive, he's going to be looking over the shoulder for the rest of his life. If I'm him, if I'm Tom Cruise, Mitch, and I've already moved from to Memphis, I've already taken the job, and I learn all of this, I say, I never wanted to work for the mafia, but now I do, and I'm going to make the most of it.
That is not my approach to this problem.
Please, would you follow Mitch's path?
I would go to the FBI, and how convenient for him that the FBI came to him.
What was the initial problem with that for him was that he was getting disbarred. He was going to be disbarred if he did what they wanted him to do. And
so that was one thing that you could ask Dan to confirm this, but that was one thing where I was like, okay, I went to law school 10 years ago, and this is very vague memories, and I didn't do very good on the ethics bar, but attorney-client privilege goes away if it's in furtherance of criminal activity.
I thought.
So he would not get disbarred for this.
Hold on, please.
Okay.
All right. We now welcome you to our new segment, Robin Asks a Lawyer.
This is awesome.
So, as Robin mentioned, she has many questions. Fortunately, of the three houses this podcast is being recorded in at the moment, one has a lawyer in it. Camila, care to do an introduction?
Okay, Robin, we have Dan Friedson for your question.
Attorney Friedson, thanks for joining us. Oops, on the show.
And I believe, counselor, that none of this constitutes actual legal advice.
Oh.
You guys didn't hear the whole negotiation Camila and I went through to get my advice. I planned on this being binding. And I demand payment up front. So we're going to make out, and then we'll get back to you guys. No, none of this does constitute legal advice. All right, great. Go ahead. Shoot. What is your question?
So, Dan, my understanding of attorney-client privilege is that you don't need to worry about violating it if you are trying to prevent your client from continuing illegal activity.
I will say this. The duty of attorney-client privilege can be broken by the client the following ways. One, client blabs about it, you know, to people outside the attorney, you know, in the public. Two, they are going to murder somebody.
Murder.
And it's imminent. It's not, they said they were thinking about murdering somebody. They said they're going to go kill somebody. Again, this isn't legal advice, and I don't represent murderers. So,
that you know of.
My focus has always been on just keeping secrets. But it would be interesting, you know, I don't have any background as a criminal practitioner, right, criminal law. But it'd be interesting to get that answer from somebody who does practice criminal law, like for the firm, white collar crime. And if you're talking about the movie The Firm and White Collar Crime, and you know your client might, I mean, you have to have really hard evidence, and you can blow the whistle under certain circumstances, but it's a huge roll of dice. Like, you have to have solid evidence against your client, otherwise say goodbye to ever being a lawyer. And it has to be really damaging to society to the point where people would outweigh the fact that you snitched on your own client.
I feel like the mob, if you ever want to work again. I feel like the mob might count. Ooh. As...
Yeah, we can't talk about that. The mob doesn't exist. Goodbye.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, anyway, also, speaking as an ex-lawyer, BFD. Find another job.
Right. Yeah. That's kind of where I was with the whole thing, was like, okay, so that seemed to me like that was his biggest concern, was that he was going to be disbarred. Like, he didn't. And my whole thing was like, well, did they pay your student loans off already? Because if that's the case, then fine. Just also, be disbarred.
Right. I feel like there's a few different approaches. One is try to leave naturally, right? Be like, my wife can't handle it here. I'm so sorry. I gotta go. And you've only been there for a little while. They have no idea. If you know, you haven't been brought into the inner circle, they might let you not get exploded on a boat.
And plus, he hadn't even passed the bar yet at that point.
Oh, good point.
So yes, this is, I just double checked, this is a more satisfying movie solution that isn't the legally accurate one in the book. In the book, he has violated attorney-client privilege, knows he's not going to be a lawyer anymore, and accepts that, basically skims $10 million from the firm's books, takes another million from the FBI, they head to the Cayman Islands, leaving behind a pile of evidence and a deposition, which is enough to get most of the firm and a big part of the crime family tied up in a RICO case forever.
Oh my goodness, so complicated.
Yeah, the one thing I found a little unsatisfying about the conclusion of this is that, like, the actual mobsters kind of get away with it.
Right.
They do.
Which, but, like, I understand going up against your mob law firm is less terrifying than going up against the actual mob.
Yeah, I think it's just more like, it's just like, you know, that's not my problem. Like,
right.
I gotta deal with home first, I guess. But
right,
like, it just,
like, look, I shop from Amazon.
Right, we all make compromises, and mine would be, well, where can I get the good pasta? Like, really, I'm not.
It's just because for the simple fact that it's just so complex. Like, everything that he worked out, right. I would have been just tired. But before he even executed anything, it's like, you know what? By the time I figured all that shit out, it would have been too late anyway.
Well, very belated. Let's get to some facts, most of which are about this being a very successful movie. The Firm was released June 30th of 1993, the 15th number one movie of the year. This was a Wednesday release. That's about gone. I know that all releases are gone in 2020, but like, That had faded, right? Other than maybe a long holiday week.
Back when theaters were real, everything had started opening on Thursdays.
Right.
So I can see maybe the things that want to still make themselves special now need to open on Wednesday.
I guess.
But we'll see what movie theaters are like if they continue to exist.
Yeah.
It used to just be an arbitrary event. Like, you were trying to get a jump, so you open on Wednesday instead of Friday. That has faded. But this opened before the July 4th weekend. It won that long weekend with $32.4 million in a field of five new releases. Sleepless in Seattle was new that weekend, finishing in third. Dennis the Menace was in fourth. One of those Disney Vault re-releases, Snow White and the Seven Dwarves, was in fifth. And Son-in-Law was in sixth.
Ah.
So,
Paulie,
I've met him and he's nice.
Is he good? I'm happy to hear that.
Yeah.
Me too.
Yeah. So what was in second? I conspicuously left the second place finisher off then, because that was the movie that Firm knocked out of the top spot.
Jurassic Park.
Really?
The Firm replaced Jurassic Park at number one. Jurassic Park broke the then record for highest grossing weekend of all time on June 15th, made $47 million that weekend. It would win the following two weekends and then finish second behind The Firm in its fourth weekend with $25.2 million. The Firm went on to win the next two weekends, also a three-weekend winner. It held off debuts In the Line of Fire, Rookie of the Year, Free Willy, and Hocus Pocus. Did not beat The Firm for the top spot. Also managed to stay ahead of Jurassic Park for 5 weeks. Obviously, Jurassic Park hung around a lot longer, but The Firm earned $158.3 million. It is the fourth highest grossing film of 1993, behind only Jurassic Park, Mrs. Doubtfire, and our previous episode subject, The Fugitive.
Real quick aside, I did not see Jurassic Park in the theater. I was too scared.
Pretty sure I did.
I have a sense memory of my cousin digging her fingernails into my hand during Jurassic Park.
I also watched Jurassic Park with my cousin on a 13-inch TV and still thought it was the most amazing thing I'd ever seen. So, wow. Eat it, Nolan.
The Firm was nominated for two Oscars. It was up for Best Original Score for Dave Grusin's Constant Jazz Piano.
Which, wow, yeah.
Did this movie take place entirely in the lobby of an overpriced hotel? Like, every second that guy's noodling on the piano.
And I could, like, almost see him just, like in the really tense parts, just, like, banging furiously on the keys in no real order.
I mean, I guess it worked at the time. It got nominated for an Oscar. But hearing it now, I was like, this feels more dated than when you watch something from the 40s and it has the strings going the whole way. This feels so the past.
Yeah.
That nomination was lost to John Williams' score for Schindler's List. Holly Hunter was nominated for Best Supporting Actress.
As she should have been.
I can't find the chart on this. It's one of the shortest performances nominated for an Oscar. I wouldn't have believed this if you told me. She's only on screen for 6 minutes.
Really?
She's on screen for 5 minutes and 59 seconds.
What? She's so good in that.
I know. Just like the introduction of her character. I'm like, yes, fucking Holly Hunter. Bless your soul.
Well, she lost Best Supporting Actress to Anna Paquin in The Piano. And then later that night, Holly Hunter won Best Actress for The Piano. She won Best Actress on the same night. She lost the other award.
Upgrade.
That has more common than you might think.
Really?
I checked this last night. This has happened 4, 5, 6, 7 times.
Okay, let me see if I can get some of these. Can we do a quick aside about this? Okay, Jamie Foxx.
Yes, that is the most recent.
Jessica Lange in 82 won supporting when she was also nominated for Best Actress.
Correct.
It has to have been the case with Meryl at some point, right?
No.
Okay. All right, I'm blanking. I got two.
That's pretty good.
But I also recall when Scarlett Johansson was nominated twice this past year, I did look it up. And in the situations where this has happened, more often than not, they win one award that night.
They win one or the other.
Right.
Holly Hunter and Jamie Foxx are two of the three times that someone won the big award and lost supporting. The third one is Al Pacino winning for Scent of a Woman, nominated for Glengarry Glen Ross. Huh. The other ones where a person won supporting and lost the big one, as you said, Jessica Lange in 1982, nominated for Frances, won supporting actress for Tootsie, and before that, we're in the 40s. Barry Fitzgerald.
Oh, and that's an interesting one, because he's nominated for the same performance, which is now against the rules.
What?
So there was people who thought he's like the co-lead of Going My Way, which is Best Picture winner. And so enough people voted for him in each category that he got the two nominations. And he lost Best Actor to his co-star, Bing Crosby.
That's insane. So he was nominated for Best Actor and Best Supporting Actor?
For the same
movie. Oh, my goodness.
It was the 40s. People right.
They didn't know what they were doing. It's like, we're just making this up as we go.
Really?
Like in Teresa... Dopier or something.
Right. Like we do. So, you know, 75 years from now, we'll have this shit down. Not if we follow the Oscars rules, when we'll still be changing it every single year. 1942, Teresa Wright won Best Supporting Actress for Mrs. Miniver and was nominated for Best Actress for Pride of the Yankees. And way back at the 11th Academy Awards in 1938, Faye Bainter won Best Supporting Actress for Jezebel, was nominated for Best Actress for White Banners. The times when it has happened and the person has not won either. Sigourney Weaver in 1988, Gorillas in the Mist and Working Girl. Emma Thompson in 1993, the same year. In fact, Emma Thompson and Holly Hunter were both nominated in both categories that year. Emma for Remains of the Day and In the Name of the Father. Julianne Moore in 2002 for Far From Heaven and The Hours. Cate Blanchett in 2007 for Elizabeth, The Golden Age and I'm Not There. And as Robin said, ScarJo this year for Marriage Story and Jojo Rabbit. Yeah, Jamie Foxx.
Justice for J-Lo.
Yeah, that... Ugh. Man, what a simpler time. The Oscars from this year.
Right.
The world was so different. I was going to a basketball game full of people.
Right.
Traveling, staying in a hotel. Anyway, this is one of two John Grisham novels adapted into a feature film in 1993. Both went to number one. The Pelican Brief was a number one movie in America by the end of the year. Those are two of the three John Grisham adaptations on our list. A Time to Kill was also a number one movie in 1996. At the time of this film's release, John Grisham had three of the six best-selling paperbacks in the country. Of the top six, three of them were by John Grisham. The other three were by Michael Crichton. Finally, two fun facts. Sidney Pollack wanted to change the Gene Hackman character, Avery, wanted to make that a female, cast Meryl Streep, and have Mitch and Avery have an affair.
I'm into it. I'd watch it.
Yeah. Streamlines the plot, too. Yeah, there's several characters that you can cut out that way.
Right. It would seem more plausible to me than his just, like, random thing on the beach after he had just turned one broad down. Then so it's this other chick is able to just, like, ooh, bat her eyes at him and stick his hand up her skirt. And sure, yeah, okay, now I have no morals. Like,
yeah, I did not find that particularly believable.
No,
because Mitch is kind of an idiot. He is he is going to uncover his employer's crimes despite the fact that they have endless leverage over him.
Right.
And while he's doing it, he's going to have sex with an obvious honeypot.
Yeah.
Like, what are you doing?
And boy, did they set that up fast. Because, like, they had the one girl there was the obvious one. I mean, did they just know for a fact that he was going to turn the first one down and then send him on his way? Right. It's like, get her out here now. And it's like, you go. Bianca, you're on. Go.
Sprain your ankle.
Finally, for some reason, this film was released on blue video cassettes. If you bought the firm, it was blue. They just tried something. So anyway, as much as I'm complaining about Mitch's decisions, this was a lot of fun to watch. Every character in it is fun and interesting. It's a legal thriller that never once enters a courtroom, which is interesting. Right. It's just an enjoyable, twisty time. It's enjoyably low stakes. You know, like, the worst thing that's going to happen is this one guy is going to die. You know, it's just like, oh, this guy has a problem. Let's see if he solves it. This is what perfect afternoon viewing.
And Gene Hackman. So, like, we talked about how great Holly Hunter is. Obviously amazing. I feel like Gene Hackman could have easily gotten a nomination out of this.
Yeah, he was great. And does Gene Hackman, has he ever played, like, a lovable character? Or is he always just,
Yeah.
Okay. Do you have it?
But he's usually.
When? Yeah.
I was going to say he's usually lovable but crusty. So, like, for example, I think Royal Tenenbaum counts. I would honestly say that Popeye Doyle counts, one of his Oscar winning roles.
Okay.
I think his role in Crimson Tide counts as lovable but crusty.
Lovable but crusty. I like it. I'll allow it. But yeah, like, Gene was great in this, and I guess it's just the way they do things at the firm, but I found it really odd that he, like, from Jump Street, he was trying to, like, get in her pants. Like, damn, like, hi, my name is, can you just...
Okay, and also, Gene Hackman, he looks young, which is a very weird thing for someone who also has always been old.
Right.
But, like, he was in his 60s in this movie, which is mind-blowing.
Right.
And Gene Triplehorn was 30,
mm-hmm.
and so he's twice her age, and... It didn't seem that gross, I felt.
No, it wasn't the age that was making it gross.
I mean, it was predatory.
Right.
But, like, if you didn't know that this guy's a mob lawyer, you would have this obvious thing of, like, trying to seduce a married woman. But I think it felt much more sweet and genuine than it has any right to.
Really?
Yes.
I was, I mean, it's
like,
not
when
even.
When they're drinking rum together, I'm like, this seems like a pretty good date.
I guess I liked that very quickly. He's like, hi, I'm a player. You should know that. That's kind of what my deal is. And she's like, that's okay. I'm kind of here to piss off my husband. And then mm-hmm. they're like, oh, okay, great. We know. All right, sure, fine.
Yeah, all the cards are on the table.
Right. It's also virtually identical to what happens between Al Pacino and Charlize Theron in The Devil's Advocate, minus the thing where Al Pacino is the devil.
Yes, this is like kind of the more realistic version of Devil's Advocate. Right. Which, yes, that was brought to mind several times throughout this film. It's like, oh yeah, Devil's Advocate.
Yeah. I also thought in Devil's Advocate, like, one thing that I could have, I know this movie is already way too long, but I could have used a touch more of the seduction part.
For who? Of who?
For Tom Cruise. Sorry, that was not clear. There's so much seducing going on. When they are selling him on this job, right? Mm. And when he first, like, as soon as he arrives, they're like, oh, and by the way, we're super creepy and controlling. I would love if he had, like, a little bit more, like, look at being rich, how great this is.
Yeah. Yeah, because it was like, you know, oh, the firm allows the wives to work. And she's immediately like, the fuck? Like, what does that mean?
Right. It is immediately the fuck.
Yeah.
Everywhere.
Right. And yeah, it would have made more sense for him to be like, but I got all this money. I get all this stuff. I can do all these things I want. Obviously, she came for money. So Abby, she wasn't like, this was like, whatever to her. Like, she was used to all this. So she was able to see some of the weirdness first, the cult-like behavior of the, what was it? All white, all men, all white, all married, was like all of the lawyers in the joint. In fucking Memphis.
Really? Right.
If you have that many lawyers and none of them are divorced, something is wrong.
Exactly.
They didn't say how many were widowers.
Oh.
Yes, that's true. But this point underscores the is Mitch really that bright question, because, you know, he's presented as not only is he top five in his class at Harvard Law School, he's the scene in the Cayman Islands where he's wooing the smooth talker, like he's presented as savvy and understanding and like gets how the world works, and he never questions why this place in Memphis, by God, Tennessee, is outfitting real law firm. Like, he never even questions what's going on there.
Maybe it was to be understood because he worked so hard to get through law school, yada yada, and he came from nothing. And apparently, you know, they give us the context clues of like, look at how their little ring dingy dirty apartment, like the life they're living now, and look at their terrible car, and oh, life is so horrible. And he just wants to give Abby like the best life that she's used to. And so it took nothing but like, what was it, a 5% or 15% more than whatever the top offering law firm was giving him. And so he's like, yeah, bet, let's do this. And he's like, I don't care, yeah, okay, sure, yeah, my wife can work, okay, sure, yeah, she'll want to have it, all right, yeah, okay, whatever. And I was kind of surprised that he was able, that he did start questioning things, like putting things together so quickly, that he got suspicious so quickly.
Yeah, I think maybe it would have been better if his wife had to
lead him there,
Bonnie piece him to keep talking about the vow.
I didn't think you referenced it last week, and then you did while I was looking something up. I didn't hear it until.
Yeah, it was a slick. It was slipped in there.
I didn't believe for a second when he started snooping around about the deaths on the Cayman Islands trip. Like, the way you've acted in this movie so far, you are not going to the boathouse to ask some questions.
Also, they messed up with Chekhov's spilled beer that never comes back.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
That was odd. I might take away a point for that.
Credit to Colin, by the way, for pointing that out to me.
It's canceled out by the points I added for the running gag about the guy who pretends to be Elvis. Related note, man, Gary Busey. First of all, he is doing A+ Gary Busey.
Yes. He's Buseying the best Busey he's ever Buseyed.
And it's so satisfying because I was like, this guy's going to solve this problem? Oh, no, he's going to get shot in the face. Correct.
Well, it was right. And it's like exactly the perfect amount of Busey that one needs in a film. Like, it was just a touch, just a sprinkle of Busey.
The other thing is that I remembered from my youthful viewing of The Firm was that in my youthful brain, she was under his desk to go down on him.
Yeah, that's what
reality,
I thought too.
They were just kissing and then they heard a noise and she hid.
Yeah,
I thought she was about to.
She gets under the desk though.
Really? Because I thought there was like a little flirties, like, oh, I'm going to do something for you.
Yeah, there she would have. Yeah. But it's not like she was down there to unzip his pants.
Gotcha.
They were making out and then they heard a noise and she was hiding because he's having an affair with her, or she's having an affair with him, or
both. Yeah, I think both, but her situation was a little more open than his. Like, I think she was like, your wife.
Yeah.
You know, there was a one season TV spinoff of The Firm.
Right.
That was like Mitch and his family 10 years later. And I'm like, no. The TV story was the Gary Busey Holly Hunter Law Firm. That I would watch for 8 seasons.
There was also, as I was looking for it to watch this film, of a movie with Gary Oldman called The Firm about a bunch of inmates who make a soccer team.
Why is that called The Firm?
I don't know. I mean, the firm, what, guys? The Firm, right. What? Is this a porn?
Develop locker room feelings for each other.
And some really good Wilford Brimley content.
Yo! Wilford Brimley is the fucking man. Like, this character is so hard. Like, like, he rolls in there. I'm just like, I stand for this Wilford Brimley. Like, whatever this guy, the character's name was, I forget. But he's just like, first of all, when they're all in the room chatting and, like, somebody questions what he knows or what he doesn't know. And he was like, what the fuck you think I do here? The night watchman? I'm like, Wilford, you better put him in his place. Oh my God. And then the whole, like, the iconic line, I think this is like the only thing that I remembered from like my long time viewing of The Firm, when he's like, I get paid to be suspicious when there's nothing to be suspicious about. And it's like, yes, mm-hmm. Will, yes, like Quaker Oats, get your life, man.
And I would also be remiss if I did not shout out David Strathairn at his most scorchingly hot.
Yeah. Like, he was like so tan, so lovely. And also it's a cute little, another shout out for him and Holly. They were in A Home for the Holidays together.
Which I love.
Me too.
I love that movie.
Me too. That is like dedicated, like it must be every Thanksgiving viewing. Like, yes. That is.
Yes.
I learned that there's a John Grisham Christmas movie, that Christmas with the Cranks is based on a John Grisham holiday book.
What?
And that is actually, I think that is the most recent big screen Grisham adaptation. And it was hated and there hasn't been another one since.
I had no idea
he had anything in his belt other than legal thrillers, right. And or that Christmas with the Cranks is a legal thriller.
Right. Is there a lawyer in that movie?
Wouldn't that be hilarious?
It's wacky. It is mostly children falling down in court at Christmas.
Also, shout out to Ed Harris, a nice bald young Ed Harris.
Oh, he
and the guy from Law and Order. Just every white male character actor from the 1990s
right.
Shows up in this and hits it out of the park.
Like showed up and showed out. I am here for it.
not to dwell on Wilford. My favorite thing was how
why not?
How committed he was to never moving quickly. Like there could be a foot chase going on. And he would saunter down the road and go that way. Like, he is not going to hurry. He pays people to hurry.
Exactly. Jigsaw is on his fucking payroll. That's the do dirt guy.
What a good quiet goon, right? Jigsaw makes.
Exactly. Like, he says maybe three sentences.
He is way too identifiable. The fact that everybody could be like the guy with long, light blonde hair.
Right.
You know,
almost white, and they were like, did he have an accent? Like, he was he supposed to be like Swedish or something? Because I couldn't tell.
That seems right.
But yeah, like maybe somebody that can blend a little bit more would be your better option.
Like Dean Norris, because you just say he's a little squat. That
right.
Could describe anyone.
Exactly.
Especially in the South.
I do. I do appreciate.
I've never been to the Deep South. I don't know what I'm talking about.
I've been to Memphis for like a day or two, and it was fine. Maybe it was just a layover. I don't know.
Can we really quickly talk about the pyramid?
The pyramid. Robin watches the movie and messages me about a pyramid, and I'm like, what pyramid? I don't.
What?
There's no pyramid in that movie.
And like, are you watching like, the right oh, movie? What pyramid?
So in Memphis, there is a giant glass pyramid, which appears in some of the outside location shots, or maybe even just B-roll. I'm not sure. Obviously, I need to know why there's a giant glass pyramid in Memphis.
Is it a casino, maybe?
So it's been a bunch of different things. It was a basketball arena at some point, and it had like plumbing issues. And so it was closed for a significant chunk of time.
Just like the original pyramids of the Egyptians.
Right. Right?
Plumbing issues. Fucking hell.
Imagine having an empty glass pyramid in your city skyline.
And that now it's basically a Bass Pro Shop. Like,
what?
It's now the Bass Pro Shops pyramid. And it has some other stuff. Like, it has like playgrounds and things and event space. But fundamentally, this giant glass pyramid is a place to buy.
What a waste.
Your fishing pole.
What a waste. So one of the things story wise that I appreciated about this is that Mitch chooses to tell his wife like immediately all the trouble that they're in right now. Because a lot of times in films like this, like they wait and they keep their wives in the dark and then they end up becoming liability and getting killed off somewhere or getting them further or deeper into the mess. So that was a really good move on the Reagan's part.
I completely agree. One thing though, I feel like they didn't dwell enough on how she basically kills Gene Hackman. She does. She drugs him and he drowns in his bathtub.
Right. No, that's not she. I mean, basically just because her existence at his hotel room or whatever, because he allowed her to get that close to take the files and somebody came along and drowned him in his bathtub. I'm pretty sure Wilford did that.
Oh, someone else did it? Okay.
I'm pretty sure.
It must have been when I was...
Because he was alive when she left. Like, yeah, she talked to him.
I would have blamed myself, though. And she doesn't even acknowledge that it occurred. She has no idea that Wilford Ridley showed up.
No, this is right. I mean, but either way, if she knows or if he doesn't know that Wilford shows up, by association, by her being there and them knowing that she was there, that most definitely got him killed. And I wish there was a scene of it happening or somebody just telling him about how you just couldn't keep your dick in your pants.
Yeah.
This is what got you here. your whole activities.
I mean, this movie really takes the position that men have no ability whatsoever to use restraint when it comes to their ween.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So Mitch tells her about his affair. She's pissed off, obviously, which I'm still just like shocked and amazed that we end up with them leaving together, because that would have been like deuces, bitch. But it was like when after the fact, Gene admits to her, he's like, oh, it was a setup. Like the girl on the beach was a setup. That don't matter. Did y'all put his dick in her? Like, it doesn't matter if somebody came, if they were like, look, here, you have to fuck this broad. He did it.
Yeah.
Was there mind control involved? Was it like the naked gun with the little remote? No.
And that seems to make it okay.
This movie taught me that it's surprisingly easy to get to the Cayman Islands. You can just kind of hop back and forth.
Clearly.
I kind of want to now. And I don't even like the beach, but it just looks so relaxing.
Just be surrounded by people committing potential tax evasion.
I looked it up at one. The flights are like $300. I don't know if that's because of right now where you can fly anywhere for, you know, a couple of bucks and a smile in the direction of an airline because they're dying. But
help us. Help us, please.
Even a resort for 5 nights, I found it for like $2,500. Like, you know, it's not nothing, but you could manage a Cayman Island vacation.
Uh-huh. And did this movie successfully explain racketeering, or did it? Was that just like, because when, you know, Tom is doing his downward spiral, you know, his sum up to Ed Harris at the end, he's like, mail fraud, that's racketeering, and I think that's what he's, or something like that. I'm still not.
Again, maybe we need to bring our legal advisor back, but racketeering is just running a criminal business.
Okay.
So it's like they wrote those statutes to get the mob.
Okay.
And then... And I don't, RICO is very complicated and I don't understand it.
No, yeah. I mean, Rico was like the main, the driving plot force of Sons of Anarchy, and I still have no idea what.
And the one thing I will say is that mail fraud is usually used to grant federal jurisdiction. Mm. It's like a trick to get you into federal court. But I'm a little eyebrow raisy at padding your bills rising to the level of fraud.
The mail fraud, like, because they mailed them. Once he put a stamp on the envelope, he's suggested to by a guy who's not a lawyer or a government official.
I just think it would be really hard to prove. I don't know how badly they were padding their bills. I just think that it would be difficult to prove the intent necessary for that to be fraud.
I mean, clearly they're covering up, they're using that to cover up the money they're getting from the mob.
Mm. Right.
And I guess if you're using the mail to help, but like, you have to convince me that the mailing of the document was an essential part of that scheme.
Right. Well, in 1993, it would be way more an essential part of that scheme than it is now.
True.
Yeah.
And I, you know, my last law firm job, I was still mailing people paper bills. Mm.
And now you're going to jail. There was a lie on any of them.
Oh, God.
I don't think you are. Anyway, that has been a robust conversation about the firm. We were on the firm for much longer. Hey, probably 2.5 times the amount of time we spent talking about Chronicle.
Right.
We might have hit the entire episode length of our Chronicle talk.
Right.
So let's rate it. I give the firm an 81. I enjoyed it. Robin?
73.
Same ballpark. And Camila?
74.
Yep, we like this movie. That gives us an average score of 76.
Wait, sorry. Can I add one more point? Because I'm really feeling Wilford's character. So I'd like to add one more point for Wilford Brimley. 75.
Valid. I support this.
He is OG. I love it.
Everyone knows about the Brimley cocoon line.
Yeah, I do. Camila, are you making a face that you don't know? I'm excited for someone to learn about this in front of me.
I don't think I do.
This is a Twitter account, the Brimley cocoon line.
Oh, yes. You guys hit me to this.
Right. Where Wilford is surprisingly young in Cocoon. I think he's 50. Yeah. He's living in a retirement community and looks like full Wilford Brimley. Right. So the account tweets out whenever a celebrity passes the Brimley cocoon line, whenever a person is older than Wilford Brimley was in Cocoon. And it's always shocking. Like, Will Smith is older than Wilford Brimley was in Cocoon. Like, everyone, so many more people are 50 than you think.
Right.
And towards Wilford just passed a couple of months ago, didn't he?
I think so. I think a couple years, maybe.
Yeah.
I think that's a this year thing, but we'll figure it out. But when he was on Twitter for his last couple of years.
Was
he? When he finally became aware of the Brimley cocoon line, he just replied with, "What are you saying? I'm old."
Oh, wow. He died in August.
I told
of 2020?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
This year has been 10 years.
Right? Because I swear he passed away a long time ago.
I think it was like early 2018.
Right. Yes. If anybody had asked him, like, yeah, it was like 2017, somewhere around there. It's been a couple years. Right. August. Woof. Okay. R.I.P. Will.
Well, let's get to the bingo card. Here's my big question with the bingo card. Does the fact that at the very beginning of this movie, a bus drives by with a CB4 poster
right?
on it.
I noted that as well.
Does Anomia return?
No, but Gene Hackman does.
All right.
Gene Hackman definitely does.
In my mind, it's both of those things. I was so excited.
Me too.
Anything on the bingo board?
There's
bingo
a board? Tortured argument for kidnapping, but I don't think it's worth it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess sort of, kind of, but no, I'm not going to.
Proceeding slowly, so just Anomia return today. Does that get anyone close?
I'm close. I'm like adapted from a TV show away.
Nice.
What are our, that will not help you out. We're not going to help you next week.
Nope.
But if Wayne's World had stayed in, you would get a bingo. So it's time for You Can't Handle the Truth. I recommend the new horror film Spell. Spell is in limited theaters and drive-ins right now. I'm sure that it is going to be streaming somewhere soon. Not only, but partially because we just had this conversation looking for religiously themed horror movies that are not Catholic? About Christianity or Catholicism. In Spell, Omari Hardwick is a lawyer, in fact, and is flying his family. He is an amateur pilot, and he's flying a little single-engine plane to his father's funeral in middle of nowhere, West Virginia, when he crash lands and is taken in by a old hoodoo woman played by Loretta Devine, who kind of goes all misery on him.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I love her.
Yep.
Oh, she's fantastic and underused. It's a little bit of misery in the terrifying backwoodsy Appalachia place. It's Yikes. Really good.
Can't wait.
This is also how I unintentionally watched four movies in the same day, all of which had a backwoodsy person warning that trouble was ahead.
Harbinger. Yeah, when you tweeted that, I was looking desperately for like a gif of the Harbinger from Cabin in the Woods and couldn't find it.
I saw it four times in the same day. We were here, we watched Texas Chainsaw and The Hills Have Eyes, but that happens twice. Mm. I went to the drive-in. It was in Spell. The back half of that double feature was Friday the 13th,
wow.
where Crazy Ralph comes out. Oh, and this is an endorsement that no one will follow. But speaking of the drive-in, Friday night, I went to one I hadn't visited, the Hilltop Drive-In in Chester, West Virginia. It's very, very lovely place to watch It Chapter 1, followed immediately by It Chapter 2.
How'd that go?
That's a long night.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. I was there for like 6 hours. God bless them for tying red balloons to many of the little poles in between the spaces.
Yeah.
I know no one's going to do it. It's better that way. Like it's kind of the same way I feel about Kill Bill.
It's better to watch them both back to back or both back to back in a drive-in.
The drive-in probably helped, particularly on a spooky October 30th. But right. when you wait 2 years and then watch It Chapter 2, it's long and feels kind of unsatisfying.
Yeah.
If you watch them all, it's a five-act structure, two of which are in the first movie and three of which are in the second. The second movie is still not as good as the first, obviously, but like as continuing the story, it's better if you've just watched the first half of that story and does that better than the original miniseries. Mm-hmm. I know people have nostalgia for the original miniseries because Tim Curry is great. Tim Curry's pretty much the only good thing about it. And the back half of the original is unwatchably slow.
And John Ritter.
And John Ritter. R.I.P. But yeah, if you haven't gone to It yet and are still curious, if you're one of the seven people willing to watch that clown that didn't do it in the theater twice, because that was a giant hit, do them both in a row.
Yeah.
I mean, I've done it for The Godfather.
Oof. Was it like 2 days?
I enjoyed it. No, it was like we started at like noon. I made a huge batch of pasta.
Wow.
Just
all three or just first and second?
Just the first and second.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
I don't hate myself that much.
So, other recommendations for this week?
I got nothing new to report. I've been binge watching This Is Us and crying a lot. So, you know.
I've been doing a lot of the scrolling through every streaming app we have, trying to find the magical program that will make me stop screaming inside my heart and fully fail to do so. We're recording this on Election Day, by the way.
Yeah.
Also, happy birthday to my sister.
Happy birthday to my nephew.
Yay.
None of my family members were born today, but Aww. Happy birthday to my brother was last week. And so happy birthday, Andy. Yeah, that's fine. Hey, whatever you got going on this week. Here's a question. When did Sean Connery die? Was that Saturday we're recording?
Yeah.
Yes.
So that was too soon. So this weekend is the weekend that the movies are coming back to the drive-ins. I'm going to go Thursday night. Dependable is showing, I think, Dr. No and Goldfinger.
Yeah.
And I'm pumped for that. Do I like James Bond movies? I truly don't know. Like, we watched GoldenEye, and I was like, eh. Most of the Daniel Craig ones, I've been like, yeah, I love Casino Royale. Casino Royale is my favorite James Bond movie. And a lot of the I know I saw a lot of the classics when I was like in my early teens, but I have no memory of them. So I guess my question is, if I go watch Dr. No and Goldfinger, am I going to feel better? Are those the two that are going to convert me?
Who can say? Know.
I have no idea. The one we did Report was the only, back. Yeah, the one we did was the only Bond movie I'd ever seen. So... Which also, I didn't know that Sean Connery was an abuser. I didn't realize
Really into talking about it.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
I feel betrayed because...
A hard life being aware of how many male celebrities have beat up a woman.
Wow.
Because it's a lot of them.
Wow.
Gary Oldman, Michael Fassbender. Yeah.
I'm sorry. Did you say Michael Fassbender? Cares?
Johnny Depp now as a matter of the public record.
Right.
That I don't want to get into it, but I right. love that he sued a paper for saying that he was a wife beater, thus causing a court case where they said, "Well, we've proven you're a wife beater." So now they're fine to say that. Before it was just a thing they said, now it's the actual official right. truth. I am fully capable of enjoying Sean Connery as James Bond if I happen to enjoy him with that in my mind. But like, that's why I'm not posting about him when he dies, because it's like, you know.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I don't really begrudge other people for.
I mean, yeah. Do what you do, what you do, what you do. But like, again, I would like to be public record, like, because I did post something about him dying, and I didn't know that he was the way he was, and otherwise I would not have done it. But I am going to watch The Untouchables right. this week.
And then I never know, like, I feel like such a feminist killjoy all the time that I don't always want to be that person who's like, hey. Oh, and by the way, they're garbage.
Like, hey, if we go back to the 40s, there's probably very few good people in any movie.
Oh, yeah,
but...
I'm sure. Although I would really like to keep it under wraps. Whatever Cary Grant did, let it be dead with him. I don't know.
Also, I think like the worst he did was sometimes sleep with men. So,
oh, okay.
Who did it?
Right.
Who,
yeah, exactly.
And Alfred Hitchcock, too. They're like, now, did he treat his actresses like garbage? Probably.
Yes.
Shut up.
Right. It's like, I'm pretty sure, I'm like 99.9% sure, yes, that he treated his actresses as trash.
So I was looking for something to watch on Halloween after this. I wanted something spooky, and I was like, you know what? Maybe I'll watch The Shining, because I haven't seen that in a long time. But then I was like, all I am going to think about the entire time is Shelley Duvall being psychologically tormented and it ruining the rest of her life.
Aw, really? That's what happened?
I got to push that one aside to keep it as my favorite movie.
Right, but... no, so exactly. Everybody's got to do what they got to do and make their own excuses for all of the garbage people who make our entertainment.
Fuckers.
I went to one of the coolest movie-going experiences of my life on a family vacation in San Francisco, and one of the old movie palaces was doing a Hitchcock thing, and they showed Strangers on a Train and Rope, and they had an organist playing beforehand, and in between, they brought out two actresses who had been in Hitchcock movies. I forget who the one was. The other was his daughter,
Peggy.
Hitchcock, who is in Psycho, among other, a couple of others. And they asked this question. They said, well, he had this reputation. And she says, well, I never saw him doing that. Well, yeah, she did. That's his daughter.
Right.
Don't ask her.
Exactly. And I'm pretty sure
he probably didn't get
the right. He was probably pretty slick about what he was doing and when he was doing it. He wasn't just like out broadcasting and treating folks like trash.
Just to be clear, no relation.
That you know of.
Have you looked into it?
The Hitchcock side of my family's been in the U.S. for 400 years. So,
and he's
firmly, from the UK,
right?
But
right.
The Hitchcock side of my family is also from the UK.
So, just might be
right.
Maybe you're. Know.
But we would be like 26th cousins.
you've got some like 0.00072%
right
royalties coming your way.
That's like the thing when speaking of the election, this doesn't happen anymore, but it used to be like every election cycle they would try, someone would be like, do you know that Al Gore and George W. Bush are actually related? If you go back, and it's like, aren't you cute? Don't stop pretending that means anything. Go
right
away.
Right.
Anyway, we're just avoiding CNN now. That's what this podcast is.
Yeah, exactly.
Keep talking so we don't. Anyway, next week, as you may be aware, well, as you're listening to this, the poll is over. So we will now talk about what won, a thing that we are doing live and in real time, not recording all four conversations and then playing the relevant one when the poll actually ends. We're not doing that at all.
No.
Well, people like Robin's picks more than mine, because after A League of Their Own led a lot of the way, Sneakers pulled out the win, with a lot of people on Twitter saying that this is one of their, like, low-key, you know, quiet, underappreciated favorites.
That should be fun. I see that it's like a pretty big, it's a decent cast. I've never seen it. I just remember seeing the poster a lot around that time period, and yeah, like, especially tooling through like Blockbuster or Video Connection or whatever, always bypassing it.
They were like, oh, by the way, we have one of the best casts of all time.
Right.
I could think
use some more human women, though. Like, so many great movies.
I think, again, I'm speculating, I think both of your movies individually got more votes than both of my movies combined. So, thanks, everybody.
Which, you know, as the populist film critic on the pod, that's maybe a little surprising.
Well, like I said, I was deliberately going for weird stuff,
yeah,
which was not a strategic move. That would require you to also go for weird stuff. The minute that a League of Their Own or a T2 was eliminated, it rendered my strategy irrelevant. Well, yes, that movie we just referred to is our subject for next week. In any case, The Firm was released June 30th, 1993. What was the number one song in America when Tom Cruise was fast running his way through the box office?
93. Janet Jackson?
Correct.
Ooh.
Nice, Camille.
Yeah. That's the Way Love Goes.
Exactly right.
Woo!
First guess.
Look at that. Nice. See, it pays to be like, I was born and aware and alive in 93.
Number one.
Forces of Nature with some major comeback. Man, do I hope you're actually hearing this, because
right?
It looked bad for Forces of Nature.
But it climbed its way up. It clawed its way to the top.
I didn't even vote for Forces
of Nature. Oh, come on, man. How dare you? Traitor. What's wrong with you?
Well,
as the
out,
only
right?
as we thought, the only two people who enjoy that movie, and you just betray it as such. Ugh.
But clearly not, because it won.
That it sure did. We could say whatever we want about Dead Ringers, because there's no way it's winning. I mean,
I guess the thing I want to say is trigger warning.
I mean, so much is going to have to happen for any human being to hear the words we're saying right now. I mean, as we're recording this, more than not quite halfway through the poll, Dead Ringers is
dead last.
13%. A lot would have to go right. Basically, the Cronenberg people would have to
right.
hear there was a poll going on and spam us for this to happen.
So if let's pretend. All right. Well, wow. Cronenberg Twitter found Anomia, and I guess we're watching Dead Ringers.
Happy to have you. Welcome. Next week, I don't know, there's probably not another Cronenberg number one. Well, The Fly. Yeah, as we anticipated, A League of Their Own ran away with it. I'm thrilled. Like I said last week, I have not seen it all the way through. It was nearly on my list, as well as being on Robin's list. And I enjoy a good baseball movie. I put one on my list, so I'm excited.
Actually, I'm excited to go ahead and revisit A League of Their Own. I remember it being fun. I've probably seen it a couple times. And so, yeah, it'll be a nice viewing.
I am bracing myself for crying into my microphone on this podcast.
There's no crying in podcasting.
Leave it there.